Until I'm tiptoed you. .com. The podcast about pop culture, black history, and spirituality. Yeah. It's about to be a great vibe. Dr. Tip. Gonna take it away. Till I'm tiptoed you.
Hey, y'all. Hey, thank you for joining me for another edition of Tell 'Em Tip Told You, the podcast where I share with you all my musings about Black history, Black culture, and Black spirituality. Now, you know, I've been missing, and I said I wasn't going to do 2024 like that, but you also know that there is nothing like some good irritation to get your sister back on an episode. But I'm not going with the irritation yet. I want to think through some things before I get there, but I am going to mention it by the end of this episode. But I want to start this week with just the question of what do the Book of Clarence, Cowboy Carter, and the Black Arts Movements have in common? And by the end of this episode, I hope to get you there. So I've talked about the Book of Clarence before, and I told you I wasn't going to go into detail because I didn't want any spoilers to be out there because I wanted you to watch the film. It's been long enough, y'all. If you haven't seen the Book of Clarence by now, please, it's streaming on Prime. Please see it. It was produced by Jay-Z, which is something that it has in common with Cowboy Carter, right? The Carters. But I really want you to see this film because, as I said before, I don't think that there is another Black liberation story as strong as that one that's out right now. And I think it got overlooked because of all the drama that people had going on about whether or not it was blasphemy. That foolishness, just like we're looking at this foolishness now with people calling yoga demonic, really comes from limited thinking and people who don't want to explore things in depth. They're afraid of intellectualism. And that's another story for later on in the episode. But let's just get into the Book of Clarence. I really want you, again, to see this story. It's the story of a man who is convinced that he is no one, right? That he's living in such a way, the evidence is that he doesn't think he has options. He's in love with a woman. He wants to put his mother in a nicer home. He's been betrayed by his twin. And he's just kind of making do with the things that he has. But he doesn't see himself as being capable of much beyond that. But you could tell from the very beginning of the film that he's a likable person. He is he's a little bit of a trickster. You know, I like that, you know, but it's so much power in the story. And because there are a lot of us. Right. And so that's why I want us to really watch the film. I think you'll enjoy it. In the film, we watch Clarence take a winding route to be redefined. Right. He becomes his highest self as a result of his own antics. Right. And the experiences he has. And I think that's a powerful message to many of us that we think that the mistakes we've made, the missteps we've made, the failed relationships we have may have put us in a precarious situation and kind of blocked us from our own potential. But I think what we can see in the Book of Clarence is that, no, these things that we experience, the people that we meet along our path can actually be our stepping stones into our greatness. Right. It's very familiar for those of you who may have read Sunjata, an epic of old Mali, the traditional Black studies text. Right. It's a beautiful book if you haven't read it, by the way. It's reminiscent of that, of how these experiences we have throughout our lives that we see as problematic may actually be the things that are shaping our potential success. So Clarence is having this kind of experience where he's hustling the people. But along the way, he's learning something about himself. In fact, because he doesn't see his full potential and the women around him do, there's a scene where the woman who has his heart is speaking to his mother, and his mother says to her, Clarence is a giant who thinks himself an ant. And I think that's so true for our people in general, that many of us see blackness as a pathological thing to abandon, when in reality, it is what makes us so powerful and so mighty. Just like Clarence could not see himself, there are far too many of us that cannot see the greatness of our people. It's a perfect narrative about rebirth and transformation, right? That even when we are not trying to be reborn, if it is our destiny, it is going to be hard to run from it, right? Clarence does not step willingly into his greatness. He almost stumbles into it. But I think that is a testament to what happens when you got a praying grandmama, when you got a praying mama, when the women around you support you. I think also this film is very good for talking about how women can shape men in a way. Right now, many of us are sick of the bear in the woods conversation, and we're sick of the drizzle and the sprinkle bullshiggity, and this false perception that it's men versus women. The Book of Clarence reminds us that we are strongest together as a unit. Even the brother-sister relationship, I don't want to, again, spoil too many things. The brother-sister relationship that we witness is a powerful one. But I want you to really view the movie as a rebirth story. Let's look inside for the narrative that's underneath the current and not just be entertained by the film. As Clarence's mother says to him, I want us to be the body and not the shadow, right? Some of us are moving through life a shadow of our potential and not our fullness because we're afraid of taking up space. We've been conditioned as Black people not to take up space, not to demand ourselves, not to have our voices heard and respected. And I think the Book of Clarence is a good lesson in what that can look like, right? And so that's the Book of Clarence. Now, the second thing I asked you about was Cowboy Carter. And by now you've heard it. If you like me, you've been binging it. And I am enamored with the deep thinking it is inspiring among a whole lot of people, right? It's not just an album. It's not just one genre. It's a historical, political manifesto about legacy and ownership and authority and strength and resilience and, right? To me, it's in the vein of Toni Morrison. It's that I can write on the surface for the people who only listen superficially, or I can tell a whole story underneath the surface. And I think that's what's most beautiful about Cowboy Carter to me. There are many discussions online about the intentionality, whether or not it's intentional. I know I had a back and forth with a sister on Threads about intentionality. Let me tell you something about me. I ingest Black art, giving Black artists the benefit of the doubt. So I'm always going to think that they mean the best in their work, right? That's my first assumption. Now, I might, once I critique it, might feel something different, but I try to approach the work like that. But I think it's important for all of us to know that we hear what we expect to hear. We see what we expect to see. So if you have a problem with Beyonce, you think she's a culture vulture, you're going to receive Cowboy Carter through that lens. On the other hand, if you think like I do, that she's an artist and that she's a student and that she is much more aware than a lot of people give her credit for, you're going to hear and see things much differently. Now, just a couple of things. There was a guy on, I'm going to put his act in the show notes because I can't recall it right now off the top of my head, but it was a white guy, a musician, on TikTok today. And he was talking about the three sonar pings you kind of hear throughout the album. And that he talked about the water and he talked about, reclaiming that which has been drowned from memory or forgotten to the water and things like that. And he's talking about it on one level. But as a devotee of Lukumi, and also knowing that Beyonce is familiar with Lukumi and definitely Oshun, I hear the references to water in this album much differently than he may. I hear when he says, she has a lyric that says, I pray to her. Like, come on, y'all. I hear that differently. And so the album is a beautiful one to me because I think it's multi-layered. And I really think we see her maturity in creating a story beyond the story that most people can hear. And that is a very African way of communicating. I'm back to writing. So I'm working on the Roots in Writing book that I've been working on since 2013. But I got a couple of chapters done now and I see the end in sight. So hopefully by the end of the summer, we're going to have us a draft. But in that book that I'm working on, I'm writing about how in traditional African written language, in how we communicate with one another on several different levels at the same time. And some, when we're crafting these messages, there is a message that's universal for everybody who encounters the message. And then there are usually sub messages, or meta messages that are only, they can only be conceived by people literate in the shared language. Okay. So what I mean by that is just like I'm using this example of the sonar pings that this gentleman is speaking of, he's going to read it in a much more superficial level, lacking the esoteric insights that I might share with her because of our shared knowledge of Oshun. And so I think this album is beautiful because it's making people think. All right. So when I get to my pet peeve at the end of this episode, I'm going to try to tie that back in. You tell me if I did a good job or not. But I think that's part of the beauty of Cowboy Carter. It's this, I'm going to make you think. Right. So let's then jump into my third thing, which was the Black Arts Movement. It is I know you've probably heard me say it is probably my favorite time in history because of what it stands for. The Black Arts Movement is the sister movement to the Black Power Movement. And Larry Neal wrote probably, I think, the foremost definitive text on the Black Arts Movement. So if you want to know more about what it is, then you turn to Larry Neal. But in it, we find a quote. And he says, the main tenet of Black power is the necessity to define the world in our own terms. All right. So that's what the Black Arts Movement is. It's about defining and reclaiming a Black aesthetic as a, quote, motive. Its motive, excuse me, is the destruction of white ways of looking at the world. So the art that's generated through the Black Arts Movement is designed to help Black people see themselves from their own perspective, right? Ngugi Wa Thiong'o talks about moving the center, that as a result of enslavement and colonialism and neocolonialism, many of us view the world through somebody else's lens, right? And the Black Arts Movement was a very intentional movement meant to shift our focus back to our own center, right? That we begin to view the world through things we think are beautiful, through a self-definition of beauty and of importance, right? It's an ontological shift that occurs in the Black Arts Movement. Now, I want to talk about what I think these three things have in common, and we can sum it up in Sankofa, right? Sankofa is a Chui term, which means stop, go back and get it, or there's no shame in reclaiming from the past. It's sometimes represented as a heart shape, kind of, that appears in the ironwork of Mobile. That's what my master's thesis was about. But it's also represented by a bird facing forward with its head turned towards the back. And I want to comment to you, if you did not see my Threads post, that I think it is intentional that Beyonce on the cover of Cowboy Carter is sitting on a horse that's facing one direction where her legs are facing another direction, that she's speaking directly to Sankofa, right? And I think the Book of Clarence speaks to pulling things from the past, because this is historical fiction, right? Pulling things from the past and hoping to shape the future through that re-understanding of the past. And I think that's what these three things have in common. The Black Arts Movement, the Book of Clarence, and Cowboy Carter are all about us shifting focus to put things, contemporary things, in a historical meta-narrative, right? We need to understand as a people the historical context of modern reality. You cannot understand, let me use myself for example. You can't understand Tiffany, not fully, if you don't understand who Nettie Rain was, if you don't understand who Bertie Pogue is, if you don't understand who Richard Pogue is. You can't understand me if you don't understand the things that have made me, right? You can't know me unless you know Savannah's attitude. You can't know me unless you know Moses' spirituality. Right? You have to know certain things about my past to know me completely. And I think that these three things have that in common. You cannot know, Clarence cannot know himself until he knows what else he's connected to in the Book of Clarence, right? In Cowboy Carter, I think what Beyonce is helping us to see on one of those levels of understanding, right, is you cannot define country music without knowing where it comes from, what it is, what it can, even the musical instruments in it, right? You can't understand its tendency towards heartbreak and violence without understanding the blues and spirituals from that, right? You can't do that. And the Black Arts Movement reminds us that if we're trying to see the world through somebody else's lens, we're missing the real beauty of it. And so that's what I think these three things have in common. In the Book of Clarence, you will hear him say throughout the film, the protagonist, that knowledge is stronger than belief, right? People can believe that country music belongs to Southern white folk. They can believe that. But if the knowledge says something to us, knowledge is always stronger than belief. I know it. Faith is not something you don't stand behind, you stand in front of it. You shape your faith. And I think that's the lesson that I want to share with you from this week. So that's what I think those three things have in common. I think they're a reclamation of self, right? Through Sankofa, a reclamation of self through Sankofa. So I've said all that. I want to talk to you. I received my doctorate from Emory University in 2013. And I'm completely disturbed by the violence perpetuated against nonviolent protesters on that campus this week. I am disturbed by the number of student arrests that have happened on college campuses lately. And I'm not going to go deeply into it because, you know, I like to think through things before I talk about it. I want to say this, y'all. This is a point where we should be able to point to the GOP and say, you kept telling people that institutions of higher learning were liberal spaces. But I think we see how fascist they can be right now. And I want us to all notice that this is about money. This is about private institutions, by and large, private institutions trying to protect donor dollars. Okay? Because you can't convince me that if Emory didn't feel that their endowment was threatened, that they would be manhandling white women professors the way that they did. Right? Tasing people who are already in hand. I don't believe they would be doing that unless they thought donor dollars were going to be threatened. Okay? When we saw what happened to Harvard's president, MIT's president, so on and so forth, we should have known, and many of us tried to warn, sound the warning alarm. We should have known that what was happening was an attempt to begin to hold these institutions hostage, Because if we look at this thing contextually, what has happened at the K-12 level eventually has to happen in higher ed. And so when we see book banning, the loss of teacher autonomy, things like that happening at the K-12 level, we should be sure that shortly behind that, there was going to be a policing of thought in higher education. And that's what we begin to see. Now, what's problematic, and I want to have some people on here to talk about it, who are actually at these institutions. What's problematic is that the strategies that some of these protesters are using don't seem to be sound. Right? They don't seem to be sound. And part of that, I think, this is just Tiffany. Again, I want to have an episode with some experts. So if you feel like you're an expert, send me an email at drtip@tellemtiptoldyou.com. I think that there has been a disconnect between the protesters of say, the Black Power movement and student protesters of today. There's not a sharing of strategy. And because of that, I think students are trying to do this on their own. Now, I'm very proud. I should have said that first, because I don't want you to get this twisted. I am very proud of students standing up for the things that I think they should stand up for. Right. And if nothing else, I don't care what side of the debate you fall down on. I mean, personally, I do care. But I'm saying, as a professor, I really don't care what side of the debate you fall onto. I have a problem with the censorship of public speech, of free speech, freedom of expression, particularly when it comes to things like war. But I want us, particularly as Black folk, to pay attention to the student protests of the 60s, right? My mother, I was having a conversation with my mother the other day, and she was like, oh, these protesters, they shouldn't be doing this. These kids might not graduate. And I was like, wait a minute, mama. Like, you went to college in the 60s, right? What's going on? Do you know that most of the freedoms we have, particularly as Black folk, we would not have if it had not been for student protests? But there has been a deliberate attack on how we study history and the relationships between generations. So whenever I see that on social media where people are talking about Gen X this and Gen Z that and the millennials that, no, listen, those are purposeful attempts to keep us separated from one another. We have to belong to one another to share strategy. Ella Baker was very clear that students had to be involved in this thing. And so I think we see it in some Palestinian response to what's happening on college campuses, that finally the United States is showing some type of ethical and moral conscience. It's because of students. Young people have always driven this country towards its potential for full human rights and citizenship. And when the young people are attacked and the places where young people find themselves, then we're really in trouble. I just wanted to say that little bit because I couldn't. I'm going to think through it, and then that'll probably be next week's episode. But I wanted to make sure you know where I stand. I am disgusted with Emory University. This is not the first time they've showed their complete ass. But it is, it's horrible. And I am really embarrassed. But I will say this, I don't think it's faculty. I don't think it's faculty. From my time at Emory, the faculty there are very insightful. I think you can see that because some of them are standing up for the students, and just the institution itself. But I want us to remind ourselves that private institutions are still places where white supremacy lives. So we just gotta do what we gotta do. All right. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you have a fabulous rest of your day. Tell them to told you.